The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
Start with a little bit of recap from actually, Fridays ago. But just a reminder of things to keep in mind while you guys are testing. You know, on one hand, most of you are pretty much the most expert players in your game at this point in time, as compared to anybody else in the world. You know the game better than anybody else. And the kinds of things that that means you suck as a tester. But you still have a role to play as testers. You can be looking for the degenerate strategies, and you can be looking for exploits. Sometimes it takes more imagination than a sneak that MIT student is available has available to them to be able to see these exploits. But because you know the systems better than anyone else, you're in a good position to spot that. The kinds of things that you're looking for are obviously, you know, strategies where there's like a dominant strategy, and I mentioned that the last time we were in this room. But also look for those strategies where, like, okay, I have to those decision points where I could do decision A or I could do the decision B, but if I change my strategy and nobody else's changes their strategy, I just screwed, you know, and that makes it really, really hesitant for someone to say, well, strategy B could be really interesting, you know, I could go for this kind of play, but on the assumption that the only way how this is going to be beneficial is if everybody else also changes their strategy, now you have a situation where nobody wants to try that second option. You know, that's one way to think about saddle points. You know, it's like if you change your decision and the only way that you can change your decision is at a cost to yourself. You know, and the benefits of changing that decision is going to be like higher than it's going to be lower than the risk that you're taking on. Then, you know, you've got a situation where it's very difficult to break out of one dominant strategy. So if you've got a situation where there are like three dominant strategies, then none of them are dominant anymore. You know, it's like, you know, that's great. You now have an option of the things that you can choose. So that's just one thing to keep in mind while you guys are looking at a game. You know, if everyone just ends up adopting the same strategy, and you're just hoping the chance of the chance of drawing the right cards going to win your game, then you start to think, then you've got a game where the individual player's decisions aren't quite that influential on the outcome. And I still need to play your games to be able to see what you guys are going for. But for the most part, it looks like you guys are not going for a purely chance-based game. You're looking for something where someone's decision actually matters. So that's one reminder from a game theory point of view. And the other one, I never really got time to talk about games as a system of conflict, and we don't have a huge amount of time because we have today's readings to go through. If you think about games as, you know, games where multiple people are striving for some sort of goal and they're going to be winners and they're going to be losers, then the idea of thinking of games as some kind of conflict makes sense. And you can think of them as, you know, are games competitive or games cooperative? Folks throw out some games that are known to be cooperative.
Perfect. That's who called it.
There are certain modes in certain different games that, you know, sort of flip it from competitive to cooperative.
Left 4 Dead.
Left 4 Dead is designed for four people to play, all going for the same goal.
Gears of War
multiplayer. Yeah.
Yeah.
Diplomacy is interesting. Yeah, because like it's kind of a risk of cooperation.
Now I play. Yeah.
That was what doesn't.
Pandemic.
Pandemic was you against the board, actually, you against the game rules. And actually, that feeds into today's lecture a bit. So hang on to that idea of pandemic. But there is one argument that all games are competitive. Even games like Left 4 Dead, where you're playing against a computer, or Pandemic, where you're playing against the game rules, or
Shadows of Camelot.
Shadows of Camelot, I'm not playing.
There's also a trade-off. Yeah.
you're mostly playing against the game rules, unless there's a trader, there's not always one in the game.
But you know that but the basic idea is that even in a purely even a game that's generally assumed to be co-op, you're still playing against the world. So it's competitive against the world. You're not competing against the other human people that are playing it. If you're competing against it, anyone is probably the designer, you know, who set it up to give some challenge. So that's one way to think of all games are competitive. Obviously, the games that people generally think of as competitive, you know, zero sum games like, you know, chess, for instance, there's one winner, there's one loser, and it's a draw, and nobody wins. Those games people generally think of as competitive. But then, that's the other way to think about cooperation is that all games are also cooperative. Because if you don't agree on the rules, if you all decide not to play on the same rules, then you've got that you don't actually have a game anymore. So you all have to cooperate and say, We have the same set of rules, and we're going to play according to them. That's not necessarily the same thing as saying that everyone knows all the rules. You know, there are plenty of games, especially computer games, where you know you're going into the game not knowing all the rules, and you're going to try to figure out the rules by seeing what the system lets you. Role-playing games where you're just sort of like, you know, I want to do this. I want to, you know, get drunk now, and how do I do that? And then the GM tells you the rules, you know, where to roll against your
constitution.
Constitution? Is it constitution?
Yeah, probably.
Oh, always the possibility, right? then you get told the rules, and then you go and do it. Live action role playing games. I know there's a bunch of people here who play them. You usually get a subset of all the rules that were written for the game. You know, you get the subset that pertains to you, and you assume that everybody else has the subset that pertains to them, and that they're playing according to it. It's a strong honor system, and even in a game, especially the kinds that played in MIT, which are fiercely competitive. You know, it's like they're assassin games. You literally want to lead someone into a dark alley and shoot them. Even then, you have to assume that whatever rules that person, you know, leading down a dark alley in order to shoot them, whatever rules they got, they're playing by those rules. They're not going to say, you know, it's like if you shoot that man and say, that didn't work, you have to assume that actually didn't work because they have rules that tell them when it works and when it doesn't work. So it's still cooperative even though it's competitive play. And some terminology now. The systemic cooperation, which is, you know, this is what I'm describing, is the you are agreeing that the system works, and you are agreeing how the system works. These are the ways how I'm going to interact with the system. If I'm going to be playing GoldenEye or Perfect Dark on a split screen, or Halo on a split screen, and you agree not to look at somebody else's screen, then that's a systemic rule. You might also decide, no, it's on the screen, I can't avoid seeing it, therefore we can all look at each other's screen. Mm-hmm. That's also a systemic rule. Even though the goals are the same, let's shoot each other. And then there's player cooperation, which is a little bit more like the games like Pandemic and Left 4 Dead, where you're explicitly trying to help each other attain a shared goal. And that I'm just trying to sort of like differentiate the two, because it's useful sometimes to sort of try to figure out the differences. There is a game that I don't think we're making you play called The War on Terror that we have in the lab. And one of the things about this game is that this game actually doesn't end. If you look at the rules, it seems like there are conditions for the game to end, but they're really, really hard to reach. And if you're interested in seeing how the game ends, you know, I'll be happy to pass you the board, and you can try to figure it out or play it. But of course, that's the point that they're trying to make, right? It's a war on terror, it never really ends. It just keeps going. It perpetuates yourself. And it's designed to be a competitive game. Everybody tries to take down all the other states, the other nation states, by either sponsoring terrorist activity or trying to defend themselves from terrorist activity, which means everybody is responsible for terrorism in the end of the game. But in the end, what you're hoping is that at some point in time, the players are going to cooperate, so this game is not going to end. That was the whole point of the game. And the entire group coming to that conclusion in a shared way, you know, is kind of what the game designers are trying to go for. It's a funny game. Anybody who played Crunch is the same, is done by the same folks, but it's a little bit more on the we have an opinion and we want you to hear it than, you know, this is a game that you actually want to try to play. It's funny. It has a balaclava with the word evil on it. So. And you wear it at a specific time in the game. So that's some opinions about cooperation. That's systemic cooperation, where you're agreeing on the rules, or you're agreeing that the system works. And that's player cooperation, which means players are actually agreeing to work towards some sort of shared goal. And there are games where it flips between cooperation and player cooperation and player competition. It's like Castle Crashers. Who's played Castle Crashers?
Yes.
It's a great game. It's an Xbox Live Arcade game. You run around. It's a side-scrolling game where you're a little knight with, you know, a sword.
Magic abilities.
Oh, a sword?
Well, no. It can be an axe.
Yeah.
It can be a fish.
Some sort of bludgeoning device.
A fish.
A fish is awesome.
This isn't a problem.
And in general, you know, if you're playing with three other people with controllers right next to you on the couch, you're pretty much going for the same goal. There are U4 and there are a whole bunch of baddies on screen and you're just trying to kill it all. But then as soon as you beat the last one, the game switches from defeat all the baddies to save the princess. And wait a minute, that's one.
No, you've already saved the princess, it goes from to get the princess.
It becomes get the princess, there's one princess, that's four knights, and it becomes a competitive game. All of a sudden, and it's like everything that you're using against the baddies becomes something that you use on your teammates. And there are games that flip-flop between that. Diplomacy is a really fluid game in that sense. It's like you have to assume everybody's competitive in that game, but the only way to attain your goals is to cooperate occasionally. And so you know, that all that's player cooperation. No one's disagreeing on rules. So that's systemic cooperation all the way through. But then there's player competition and cooperation to be back and forth. So that's cooperation. Finally, think a little bit about level playing field, about what it means in your game to have a level playing field. Because, you know, in many of your games, especially card games, they're going to start with some sort of deal. They're going to start with some sort of hand, or maybe a drawing in some sort of a systematic way from a shuffle deck. That pretty much means that, you know, you're starting out with something that's effectively random, but then it could be also influenced by your knowledge of the game, by the skill of the game. And you want to see how do you want to balance it between someone's skill, familiarity with the game against pure chance, right? You know, a level playing field means a different thing to a lot of different people. For some people, it may mean no matter what skill level I am, I have a chance of winning. So you're sort of biasing it towards chance. For some people, it means a level playing field is no matter what hand I get given, there is a valid strategy. Or the goals then get set in a way that allows me to attain it. A lot of trick-taking games, especially games with bidding, actually have an automatic correcting system. In there is that you only bid a game that you think that you can win. And your whole idea is the game is to push your opponent to bid on something which they couldn't actually get. So, you know, that's a level playing field, right? I can have a crappy hand and still win. But that's not chance so much as the decisions that you're making. So what I will advocate in this class, if there's still time in the testing, and of course there's tomorrow time like that today, so we just have all of it, is when you're trying to balance it out towards whatever your interpretation of a level playing field is going to be, try to pick decisions that sort of push you in the direction of meaningful decisions. Things that players can make a decision and they can see the consequences. They can understand how those consequences play out in the game, and the outcome. And the outcome of the overall game is going to be a result of that. That is, again, not necessarily the only definition. So I want to be very, very clear. what I'm asking of you here is not necessarily the only definition of a well-designed game. You're designing a game to be played from ages 3 to 90. You know, you probably want a game where making a meaningful decision isn't going to bias the game to the point that the really experienced people or the really smart people are going to end up winning the game. Because that's just not for the three of us. In this particular class, try to bias it so that in that competitive sense, you want everyone to feel like they have a chance of winning. But I want you to bias your game towards the and whether you win or lose is going to be based on the outcome of these decisions. Clearly understanding the outcome of the decisions that you made in the game, not necessarily just what you wish, what you were dealt or what you wish had a level of draw. You can still use those things in your game, right? You know, sometimes it's the whole idea of oh my god, I hope this is the right card. I hope this is the right card. But then you think like probability, right? You know, it's like how much information are you giving to the player about what the probability that that's the right card going to be? Are you letting them look at the deck ahead of time? You know, are you giving them information about how many of those cards are in the deck? You know, so that you can actually make guesses on, all right, we've played through half this deck, and we haven't seen any of those cards yet. That means the probability of that card showing up is now gone up. And that's now becomes a decision that you get to make. Do I draw? Do I hold? That's something. So that's my suggestion for this class. I would love it to be able to see a little bit to see those kinds of games come out of this class. Okay. So that's all the things that I had written in there. So now I can erase that after this class. All right, so before we move on, anyone have any questions regarding that? No? Okay. One point of administration, who here needs to print on Gambit printers? Right, or who here has access to other printers that you guys are fairly confident about using for your assignment?
No, I mean,
would
you say that you need a printer or you have access?
Because
you said both.
Right. So, who needs to use Gambit printers? Who absolutely needs to use Gambit printers? Okay, because we don't actually have like a computer set up for anybody to just log in, and actually all our URLs just started working. So I would suggest not using any of the computers in the lab because they all have to get off of their lab work on it. Okay, so if you've all got access to printers, that's awesome. I know you sent out an email about cardstock.
That cardstock's actually out of stock.
That's ironic.
Yeah. I went to order and I was like, oh shit. I want to take off at a long time. I'm not sure there's other cardstock.
Isn't there like a Staples or somewhere near?
Harvard has a Staples. Downtown has a Staples.
Copytech has
I went to Copytech and they said they can print and cut your cards for you.
Nice. Yeah, they have a pretty awesome card printer. Their cutter is harsh.
What does that mean?
Well, first of all, it's really pointy at the corners, which is kind of cool if that's what you were going for. But okay.
can they roundy it, or do we have to use?
No, I don't. They can't.
They can't. I have a rounder. I have a corner card punch that you have to do it four times for each card. So
we'll do it.
Just ask me and I can borrow it. You may want to do it on some test cards before doing it on all your cards, just to get a sense of how it works. It works better on card stuff than it does on anything paper. And I wouldn't suggest punching more than one card at a time. The other thing is, if you're printing it on a not like Copytech, where they obviously know what kind of paper works best with their printers. If you're printing it on something like a LaserJet, if you go to the paper manufacturer's website, a lot of them actually specifically state LaserJet compatible. And the problem isn't actually the weight of the card. It's not like the folding of the paper as it goes through the printer. It's whether the toner will bond to the paper, the paper get hot enough, without catching fire. That the paper get hot enough for the toner to actually bond. And a lot of cardstocks actually don't, because they're so thick that the heat doesn't transfer well. And as a result of that, after it prints, it looks great when it comes out and it starts flaking. So that's the problem with the cardstock. Sure, some cardstocks just jam your printer, but majority of them modern laser jets actually that deal pretty well with that. Because what is with that with paperweight adhesives?
Yeah. Did you want us to print on cardstock for Wednesday, or was that for when it's due?
When it's due.
Okay.
When it's
due. So when
it's
clicking.
And in fact, printing cardstock for when it's due is not necessary. It is much appreciated. It was a great thing for you to do for yourself if you want to make copies for your friends of your team. Then you actually want to end up playing. To be perfectly honest, if you say, you know, our printer wasn't working and all we could do was use like regular weight papers, but it's all been cut in the right shape so that I can make, so that we can just play the game, that's fine. We can still, you know, we're not going to take the weight of your paper into the cover of the game.
Wear the deck first. Point to grams per card.
It's in ventilation size.
Alright, and if anyone played, what was it, High Society? Sometimes.
Yes.
Those are
awesome.
They were like kids' books, you know?
Yeah.
Alright, cool. If anyone does have issues printing, before you jump straight into the demo printer, talk to Jason or I. Jason is usually in the room right next to the TV lounge. My room is just down the corridor. And we might be able to help you with that. But in general, if you've got access to other printers, go right for it, because going through us is a bottleneck. Again, not for Wednesday. For Wednesday, you just have something testable, so that folks can print. But before the date is due, try to print something. You don't want to leave it till the last minute, and you don't want to like suddenly realize that your paper doesn't work very well with the printer on the last minute. Okay. Right. So today's reading was Bartle and Chapter 11, I think, of the Brathwaite book. And in general, they have both of them are asking the same question, which is, who are you designing your game for? On the assumption that you're not designing the game for yourself. And of course, realistically, if you're going to get a job making games, that's the majority of the games that you're going to design are not games like games for yourself, they're going to be games for some other demographic. The Bartle paper is a little bit more influential in sort of helping people think about games, because it kind of shifted the question from what's the age group, what's the demographic, you know, what do people out there who are already buying games going to want? And he kind of flipped that into what sort of things are people looking for in the game. He doesn't actually take it to the next step, which is I think he wrote that in the 70s or the 80s. Did anyone remember?
I think it was like 90.
Oh, yeah. Early 90s. I think it was the
80s.
The question was 1990.
Right, yeah, he talks about WoW, actually, I think.
EverQuest,
that's right. But a lot of the ideas come from the 70s, actually, because that's when he made the first MUD. Richard Bartle,
the guy who made it. What exactly is a MUD? They never actually described. He just assumed everyone knew what MUD was.
MUD stands for Multi-User Dungeon. Anyone want to describe one?
It's like an online text adventure thing where everyone's kind of like interacting with the same text-based dungeon thing.
The best way to describe it is imagine that WoW was presented in interactive fiction.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's it.
Right. Yeah. So I found that kind of annoying, the text. He just assumed everyone knew what MUD was, mm-hmm. but never actually said, this is what MUD is.
Yeah, because the folks who are reading their article, actually, I believe he formatted that for a forum post for a MUD community. So there's assumption. apologies for that. Actually, if you're interested, he actually does define it right at the bottom, which is like right at the end of the article. He actually talks about specifically this is what I mean by MUD. Somewhere in the footnotes, where it's like, you know, these text adventures. Text-style online games with multiple people interacting, and if you look at the rest of the website, there's actually a bunch of stuff about how MUDs work. But for the most part, that was sort of online multiplayer gaming back when he started. He's credited for having built the first MUD, and frankly, not all that different from MMOGs that you get today. You know, the main difference being that they were all text. But you still went out hunting monsters. They call them mobiles or mobs. And in fact, actually, there's still some of that terminology going around. They drop loot. You know, you will pick up this loot and show it off. And sometimes some games that you sell off the loot, most games that you exchange loot. And then you would use your loot to go and kill other monsters and get better loot. Sometimes you do it with other people. Sometimes you attack other people. Sometimes you just hang around and chat and talk about things that are completely not in game. Like, what if I have a lunch today? Oh, some awesome chicken. Sometimes it will take multiple people to take down a monster. You know, and it was just handled out of, you know, how fast can you type kind of thing. You know, attack monster, attack monster, attack monster. And I think you can just hit repeat, heal. The behaviors are also not all that different. And how he describes it is a game kind of will kind of cite itself in a position where it is like variably appealing to various kinds of players, and that's how he described it. Where game studies has kind of gone to on since then is the realization that just because you are some people want to throw out the four types that he
Explorer,
killer, socialist, killer. So, you know, it's like there are these four types of players, and just because you're an achiever in one game doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be an achiever in another game. Different people play different games, or possibly even different times of the day in the same game for different reasons. And that's where we go back to earlier concepts that we brought up in this class, like the different kinds of fun. What are people trying to get out of their gameplay? But he was, you know, if you're looking at the context of any one mud, you know, and a little slice of what you saw of somebody's personality when they were logged in and all the things that they were doing, and the kinds of things that they tended to keep doing every time they logged in, it was fairly easy to sort of stereotype them into somewhere along those lines. Even he acknowledges that nobody's really all the way on one of these lines. Griefers, I think, are the words that I hear generally used for killers nowadays, but even then, that's not quite the way that he's using it. He's actually using it as somebody who's generally still playing by the rules of the game. You know, they're out there to cause misery to other people, but they're not there to break the game. There is a class of people called reavers where they're deliberately trying to find ways to exploit the system to just make the game just kind of silly. But all the other dynamics that he draws out are very much there. Like you get a whole bunch of socializers together, people who want to do nothing but chat and have a good time, don't really care about the game, and it's going to be a whole bunch of people going right after them saying, these are great people to grief. You know, because they are enjoying themselves so much. We could end that. Second Life, you get a lot of this because Second Life has that whole, like, you know, you can do anything you want, and socializing is one of the big things, personalizing is one of those big things. But so do keep in mind that, you know, that the way that he's talking about it sounds like all of these different personalities are somewhat mutually exclusive, when really the discussion has now come to how do you sort of cater to all of these different desires at any given time. I may be an achiever today, I may be an explorer tomorrow. And he even talks about explorers thinking that achievers are beginner explorers, you know, because it's like once you've already beaten the game, what else is there left to do but explore what else the game can do? You know, So he himself acknowledges that there's some personality transfer that can happen. But it's kind of interesting how he talks about the feedback loops of people, right? You know, it's like you get a whole bunch of you get a whole bunch of achievers, and you get a whole bunch of socializers.
He said it increases
killers. Yeah, increases his killers because the competition is now higher or something like that.
But he also makes this weird assumption that there is a finite pool of people who can be playing a game, which is actually true, even in a, you know, even a 10 to 20 million player game like World of Warcraft, you know, all those things have to be, like, we don't have 20 million people logging onto one server. You know, they say, I want eight hides of sheep or something.
Right.
And it's like, show eight sheep.
Exactly. And then, like, once you hit level 80, you can start doing these raids that are just really big dungeons.
Sorry.
For a lot of people. Like, 25. It's currently 25 is the highest. It used to be, like, 40. But, yeah, and you just kill bigger monsters and get lots of loot. And then there's PvP, which you go... the main thing right now is, like, arenas, and you have a team of two or three or five, and you fight other players with your gear that you obtain by doing battlegrounds and lots of arena. Yeah, and that's basically WoW.
I can't remember, are there roleplay servers?
Yes, there are world roleplay servers. I have actually never visited one, so I can't talk about that.
So it's a lot of dancing.
Dance is typing in slash dance made your character dance, and it was one of those things that really is popular among socialized type players all over any MMO. But it's not just a solo. I mean, slash dance means other things now. It could mean I'm bored, right? You know, it's like I have nothing to do right now. I have to wait for this stupid thing to respawn. Slash dance. it's more fun than just standing there. But the there is a group in WoW, and I guess I will maybe not a group. There are folks who play World of Warcraft, and they engage in this thing called theorycraft, which is how do we optimize the way how you build a character and the things that you equip a character for to be make that character really, really good at doing one or two different things. So as you're building up, you know, a character that's designed to heal, you know, what class should they be, what race should they be, what equipment should they be getting, you know, depending on what point of time you are in the game. You know, they're going to try to like derive as much of math of the kind of, you know, cause and effect in the game as we possibly can. There's a clan called the Nidus Turks, which is I can't remember if they're actually a clan. They definitely have very hard in their life form. They are, yeah.
And
that's what they do. Yeah. It's actually kind of funny. The Nidus Turks forums had one guy who just happened to write a forum post about dressing up in real life. Like, you know, like this is how you get like really nice tailored clothes, and these are things you'd be looking for, because he worked at a men's fashion space. And it turned out that community was really, really, really interested in learning more about that. Which is actually not that weird, right? It's like you care about what armor you get in the game. You care about what clothes you wear in real life, especially if it might have some impact on your real life. The job that you're looking for, it's sort of like, okay, you know. So I would actually put those more in the explorers part of thing. You know, sure, they're looking to optimize. They're looking to do the best, but they're not looking to be necessarily rewarded by the game system. They're using the game system to test their ideas against. And it's like, I'm looking for a better way to suck up more damage, you know, because I'm a tank. I'm supposed to be absorbing all the damage, all the other, as they call it, all the attentions of the characters being controlled by the computer, while the rest of my folks put out a lot of damage, you know, can do their job. But I'm not interested in what the system has deemed to be. You have absorbed tons of damage, good job. I don't care what the system says. I care how the system operates so that I can optimize it through some sort of metric that I figured out and my friends have figured out and the community has figured out. So I want to understand the system, and yet that's what it comes down to. The metric that they're using it is how do I optimize it. But for the most part, people who engage in that kind of theory craft, you know, it's like, oh, no, when this armor combined with those pants, I now fireproof or something. Those are well in the area of historics, even though their behavior seems very much let's find the best solution. Whereas achievers are very much folks like, you know, how do I get to how do I get the coolest mount? In World of Warcraft, you get right hands. And every once in a while, Blizzard, the company that makes it, will release some new stuff. And the achievers are like, I gotta get that. You know, it's like, because the stakes are usually high, and it takes a lot of effort and a lot of money to be able to get one of those things. And to be able to get it, you do some sort of recognizable status. You will see someone with the limited edition, some kind of mount, and if you know that the only way that they could have done that is to spend a heck of a lot of time in this game and play the game really well, you know, that's the kind of recognition you're looking for. So that's kind of the difference between achievers and explorers. So I actually want to try one little activity, which is I got the chart that Bardo lays out, the whole player versus, you know, player interacting and acting, player and the world. And he uses this to describe where your game could be at any given time. You know, if you're acting on players, then you know you're the kind of person then your game is kind of biased towards killers. If you're designing your game to be more about interacting with other players, then you're sort of biasing it towards socializers. Interacting with the world is more the achievers. You know, acting on the world is more the achievers. You know, like, given these quests, I've beaten all the quests, and like 100% of the quest told me, that's achievers. And interacting with the world is more the explorers. It's like, you know, what else can I do in this world? You know, there are these goals that are set, that's great, but how does this world work that I can do even cool stuff?
I found the distinction between acting and interacting incredibly hard to get at. Like, I didn't really understand what he was trying to say.
It was easier. I think he came across those two terms because they sounded cute. You know, acting, interacting.
How do you interact without acting? What does that mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's
and like the really classic example he gives, like the acting on a player is like a killer trying to attack another player, but like the other player fights back. There's an interaction there. So like,
sure, but the thing about
what is he trying to say?
So I believe what he means by that is that the killer is actually less interested in what the player does back to them. I mean, in some sense, they are interacting because they're trying to see what sort of response they get, right? And it's like, I'm going to do something to this player. This player is either going to die, or fight back, or whine about the fact that I'm hitting them so much. But they're not looking for the competitive bit. They're not really interested in the, and now that person's going to turn around and attack me.
I don't know, but the whole point is supposed to be that the killers are griefers, so they really care about how people respond to them. Like, he says later on that, like, one of the most annoying things you can do to a griefer is just ignore them and not rise to the bait, right? So interacting seems to be the crucial thing. So, again, I feel like it's...
Well, okay, so, I admit that the terms are problematic. But,
I guess, if I can jump in, how I kind of perceive it is, like, does the person care about how the other thing works, in a sense, you know what I mean? So it's like, it is the case that a griefer wants to get a certain reaction, but like, beyond that, it doesn't matter, right? So in the same case with the game system, right, like I want it to do this thing, I want it to give me points, but why it did that or how the mechanic works is kind of irrelevant. I don't know, I mean, that's kind of how I understood it.
Well, in particular, like, with the interacting, When somebody is like trying to player kill or something, the reaction is not necessarily, the reaction they're looking for is to like piss somebody off, right? And that reaction is not necessarily part of the game. So like it is acting on them because you are taking like what the game allows you to do and using this against a person, but you don't care about what they use in the game against you. you more care about this like abstract idea. So I think the interaction is not actually part of the game.
So acting is specifically to do with game mechanics, whereas interacting is to do with something which is... So maybe acting is like something mechanical, whereas interacting is something dynamics related?
I see it as like acting is sort of like a single direction with mechanics. So for example, the mechanic there is being able to like hit somebody in the head with your sword, right? Whereas interacting would be the case where you are hitting each other on each other's heads with your sword, which is an entirely different thing and is more of like a competitive thing rather than the I just want to make you angry.
Well, I think the unidirectional perspective makes sense. You could think of it as going with the hitting on the head example, right? If I'm acting, then I care that information is flowing one way. I am dealing damage to you. If I'm interacting, I'm curious as to like how that is computed and what that means for me in return. Does that make sense?
Bad terminology.
A bunch of other examples of things that you do to like maximize interacting versus acting, and like the interacting examples are things like make simple puzzles, and then the acting ones are like make hard puzzles. And like,
Wait, what?
So in the context of a MUD, a puzzle is often like a door. Right, you know, it's like you've got to solve this puzzle to be able to get into a new area, because that's really the only thing that like sometimes you get new loot. And the idea behind that is if you're sort of either privileging it to getting people to talk with each other more and socialize with each other more, or you're privileging it to getting people to look at the world more, see more of the world and understand how it works, then in a sense you don't want to put too many barriers between the people who've been playing for a long time, the people who just started playing, the people who who are in one area of the world and people who are in another area of the world. You kind of want quick flow. So in MUDs, that's one thing where the definition of puzzle is very specific. It's like,
but I have to move this set of levers. Another point that I found that's really strange, because I would expect an explorer who is supposed to be a world interacting person to really enjoy deep puzzles, which reward them for knowing a lot about the world.
The problem with puzzles in MUDs is that they're usually single solution. So there's less pleasure to be found in a very difficult puzzle, because all that told you was you just solved this one thing. There is still puzzle. There is still some pleasure there. The interest that most explorers are way more compelled by, kind of like the dynamics, right? It's like understanding the interaction of how of mechanics, especially if they behave in a way that might not have been originally designed that way. You know, it's like that's what they're looking for. They're not looking for what is the solution that was designed in the game. They're looking for how do I get this game to do something that it might not have been designed to do originally, but will be cool once they figure it out. So that unfortunately, you're absolutely right. That one suffers from the very specific terminology of what a puzzle is in a MUD, as opposed to the sort of more general definition of what a puzzle is. The reason why at least for achievers, hard puzzles are very important, because if you make a puzzle that most people aren't going to be able to get, being able to get that puzzle gives you some badge of status. Usually some sort of visible reward, even. It's like you're now in a location that nobody else can get to, or you now have a piece of equipment that no one else has. Whereas explorers, they will probably have a advantage in solving difficult puzzles, but they're not necessarily the sort of thing that makes them want to interact with the world. You know, lots of mechanics that sort of interact with each other in really, really interesting ways, more likely to be interesting to explore type thing. But you're right, acting and interacting are crappy terminologies. So it's like,
I mean, you're talking about how reefers are more like actors, where they try to get people to interact with them, or try to get people to annoy them. I've definitely seen
actually it was last year when we took game design, or not game design, Inter 300, where we watched a video of briefers in Team Fortress 2, where there's a there's a certain door that if they stand in a certain spot that it won't open. So this person started making everyone interact. Like, okay, we're going to play a game show. If you want to leave, you have to answer correctly.
Yeah, what is the capital of you?
See, like that I see that as more of like an explorer thing. Like you found some weird combination of the interaction and the mechanics that allows you to do something new, which is turn Team Fortress 2 into a game show.
it was pretty funny.
Can't fight. Brief explorer is a combination of bottle types, right? If you're going to be a successful briefer.
and that's absolutely true, right? If your personality is oriented one way, you may have to engage in some other behaviors in order to be able to maximize that core behavior that you're looking for. So yeah, you know, people who are looking at exploits trying to understand how the world works so they can cause maximum damage and maximum grief to other people. You know, that's definitely one good way of doing it. But what I find is that as soon as they find it, yeah, they are not interested in finding more ways until that first way gets boring. You know, or gets fixed. So Team Fortress, I know there's a lot of like teleporting you directly in front of a turret, stuff like that. Teleporting your own teammates in front of a turret. That's sort of thing. It's like, why do that?
I don't understand.
You don't understand?
No.
Understand what?
It's
briefers. No, it's not.
It's actually fun. It's like, I'm going to mess with you just for the hell of it.
I remember in Sims Online, an effective way to grief would be to organize a band of people and arrive in a property. Since there was a population limit, like 12 people or something on any given lot, if that lot was a business that required a lot of people to come through, and then you just had 12 of your people show up and then like mill around and sell out profanities, you could tie up the place and lock it up, and no one else could go there and visit it. Sometimes including other owners and stuff like that. It was very frustrating.
In fact, some of that behavior got towards organized crime level, actually. I mean, I was answering real crime. It was virtual. But there are actually a good number of articles about the Sims Online Mafia because that game had so much built in for socializers, to be able to communicate, express yourself. I mean, if you played the original Sims, there's a whole range of different expressive things that you can do to sort of communicate how you're feeling and to be able to chat with people. And someone, I think it might have been Max itself, actually like charted out the web of influence of all the players, and there was like one alpha player, you know, that was kind of in charge of everything. And if she decided that nobody was going, that this person was someone that she didn't want spending too much time in Sims Online because somehow pissed her off or pissed one of her friends off or something, and then she'd organize stuff like that very, very effectively. It was called the Sims Mafia. And you get that you'll get that similar behavior in Second Life a lot. And it's kind of interesting to see how different worlds respond to that. EVE Online, I think, is the world which is... Well, actually, one thing I'd like to do is I'd like to throw different games up on that chart. I am looking mostly at multiplayer games, specifically, preferably online multiplayer games. And I don't know all the games that are out there, so I'd like people to like sort of call out games and tell me roughly where it should be put up. If you disagree, then by all means put up your hand and suggest that it should be moved.
Andrew? Minecraft should go definitely towards like world interacting, like explorer type.
Like,
you're going far, far.
So what is Minecraft? I've heard of it, I just don't know what exactly.
Basically go around mining things and creating objects, and you can create like your own worlds.
So it's kind of like, I guess?
Eve is definitely world interacting as well.
Yeah. So about that same area as Eve.
I would say Eve is also player interacting.
Yeah, I guess it's in the middle then.
Well, Eve, like you have to form corporations with bunches of people in order to do anything.
That's true. you have to be really good in the social skills, actually. It's like one of the games that's like most ruthlessly captured.
Like, yeah, I was right about that, because you interact with people and the world a lot.
Like, I think it's more strongly player interacting and world interacting than most games.
You cannot ignore other players in any particular way.
But there's also like a huge amount of achievement and player versus player conflict and this kind of stuff, right? So, because surely it shouldn't be that far down the interacting scale. I mean, consider, for instance, Second Life instead, which would be like way further down the interacting end of the spectrum than EVE Online, surely.
I think,
assuming that
I'm not sure attacking like PvP is the opposite.
I think it's definitely player interaction more than player action.
Yeah, I believe it's interaction.
Like, something like having PvP tournaments, I think, would be definitely a lot of interaction.
Yeah, I think that's like the distinction between griefing and like people fighting each other.
Griefing can be interacting too. Like how he put it, what I got from his article is that acting was like I go and kill someone and ha, I killed them and that's it. Or I go through the world and like I killed monster, and you just have a goal and you want to get the goal instead of learning from your goal. So I don't know. I definitely think griefing can be hugely interactive. Like there could be a whole bunch of like if you infiltrate someone's company. And you like,
steal $10,000 worth of them.
Exactly. Like, that's hugely interactive griefing.
But the interesting
thing, I don't think that's griefing.
Consider Team Fortress, right? Is Team Fortress player interacting? Because that means it's a socializer game.
I personally do not think Team Fortress falls under player interacting.
Yeah,
okay. But Left 4 Dead is.
Left 4 Dead will.
That'd be definitely interaction.
I'd say probably more. Well, it depends on what way you're playing for. So, with Left 4 Dead, you can play, you're interacting, but then you're also, like, online, you can go against other players who are actually the zombies against you.
Right. So let's talk about the basic model where you don't have that.
Let's talk about those modes separately. Yeah.
Right.
So, the basic, most common legit mode is going to be 4 players playing cooperatively against the game world.
Mm-hmm. That's just interacting world.
And there is a lot of interaction that goes on between players because you cannot basically survive unless you get keep each other's backs.
So I would say it's
and there's built-in functions to help other people. So someone might get knocked off the ledge and be able to holding on, you have to pull them back up. At the same time, there's also an intelligent engine that sort of plans that level for you and places zombies strategically to maintain you in a state of nervousness. And so it's different every single time you play. So those kind of balance out and probably place it somewhere in the middle, maybe a little bit more player bias than world bias because you really have to stick together.
So it's weird because it almost like you want to have like a plane.
It's in like yeah.
I think it'd be I think the big problem with this sort of graph is that you can't really necessarily separate games into one of these quadrants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Games not either player or the world.
Right. And that is actually
also. Oh, I said it's more interactive.
It might be a little more useful to actually draw like areas within the graph to sort of like represent a game, I guess.
Oh, so
draw an area that encompasses like all the pieces the game sort of represents.
It might get really complicated with games that have very distinct modes. Like Halo Co-op and Halo Multiplayer and Halo Slayer, very different. That will probably be a good refinement, is just like create some sort of like scatter chart or Venn diagram.
Because I could definitely see there being a game where there's a lot of acting on the world and interacting with players, and if you're just separating these into distinct points, that isn't possible with this graph.
Right, so that's another problem is the assumption that acting and interacting are like
mutually exclusive.
Mutually opposite, at least for these two axes. It almost seems like, do people generally accept this?
Less than acting. You just warp space and then you can have like different quadrants overlap.
Maybe like a torch.
Yeah.
I think there should be different values for like player world interacting and acting. They shouldn't necessarily be connected.
Mm-hmm.
I think Eve definitely, world is very high and player is very high.
World is very high, player is very high, but as a player is interacting, and the world is acting like a world still. I mean, because, I mean, you know, I mean, you're exploring the world spatially a lot. Are you exploring the systems of the world a lot? Or are you really exploring the systems set up by people?
That's true.
I mean, the nice thing about what, you know, things like EVE Online, for folks who don't know EVE Online, the space exploration game, basically, where you start off as a captain, correct me if I'm wrong, what people do.
Pretty much a super sandbox game.
Yeah. Well, but for the most part, you're traveling in space. Mm-hmm. You know, that's
can you get out of your ship and, like, walk on foot?
Have they added that? Because I know they wanted to add an expansion where you could actually walk on planets. Last time I heard, they hadn't.
Yeah.
Last time I heard, they hadn't.
Dust 66 or something like that.
Yeah, which is a separate game.
It's a separate game.
So no, you're traveling through space. You're not, like, landing on anything. But the whole idea is that it's all built around this economy where, you know, you can do things like mining, of course, and can bring some sort of cash. But the real power in the game comes when players start to ally with each other, form armadas, form trade groups, you know, form areas that you can patrol and control, and, you know, areas where if you don't agree, if you don't get along with the people who are in control of the space, you will die once you fly in there. And the only thing that's really making that happen are other players deciding that this social contract is. So it's pretty damn amazing. What some folks were talking about earlier was there was a big story about how basically one person got into a very, very powerful position in one of these clans and decided to defect, taking the majority of one clan's financial resources with that person. And remember, this is a fairly modern investment game in online game. All in-game assets cannot be traded for real money.
It's illegal, yeah.
Illegal.
Like in game, so you can get your account banned.
Yeah.
But what happened was, if I'm talking about the one that you're talking about, someone got to a really powerful place in like this banking clan, and then took all of their assets and traded it for real money. So got $10,000 by selling it on.
One was a guy who infiltrated a clan and hacked a bunch of money. One was like a parent who was going through financial trouble and held like a fifth of the assets of some of like the major bank and cashed it in for like $6,000 to help pay off part of his house and like his kids' medical bills, and then posted an apology in the form and quit the game.
I thought you got banned from the game.
He was banned from the game, but he also quit the game.
Yeah, he was like, I'm sorry everybody, but this is kind of important.
I mean, the amazing one was the guy who actually infiltrated the company and just like took it down. It's like a years-long operation.
He was their friend and all that.
Yeah,
but
trying to get in and then managed to take down this gigantic in-game corporation.
How many players are there online? Active players?
Or active players are.
It's not really.
There's a lot of.
At
the
moment.
Yeah. No. I mean, active players who have active accounts.
Do they have like new players arriving regularly?
Yeah. Like, occasionally.
Yeah. They have really a game that they've been like.
Game.
It's like all on one server.
It's like a ridiculous learning curve.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like 4 months or something. It's insane.
But it's but the interesting thing about the particular case where someone infiltrated, took all their money, and basically decimated this plan deliberately, was that person didn't actually get their account banned for it. I believe it was like
it was totally legal in game. They didn't sell any of it.
The most recent one that I read about theoretically had the tens of thousands of US dollars of assets in the game and did not cash in any of it for real money because there was no authorized mechanism. And the article that I read, basically, the end note was, no one knows what to do with it. He's technically rich, but it's not. There's no good legal mechanism of legal game allowed. And I don't think he got banned at all.
I think he got banned because it's part of the game. It's considered part of the game. And at least for the definition of EVE, stories like that tend to have helped its reputation.
Yeah.
When they ask, this is the Wild West in space, you know, and we're trying to encourage this kind of creative play. And, you know, other than the real money transaction part, which we look at your content. All that's part of the game. So I'm not entirely sure if you can really consider that griefing. You know, it was incredibly smart, practical.
I would not call that griefing. Like, it was not. I mean, it may have been done to, like, annoy the people who are running the company that he took down, but, like, I see it as exploration. Like, I am going to try and exploration and player interaction, you know? Like,
I was thinking achieving, actually, because, I mean,
I'm not a major corporation all by myself.
Yeah, it might actually be achieving.
Do you put that in your resume, like, single-handedly?
I think if you're applying...
I could get hired by a lawyer.
And you don't mind.
Yeah.
Took down this company.
So, okay, so what I would actually like to end this this way, we've got about 15 minutes. Spend some time, I would say, how many do we have? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16? All 16? Awesome. So, groups of four, and what I'd like folks to do, am I doing this right? Groups of four? Yeah, okay. And I'd like folks to come up with other axes. Not necessarily anything having to do with models. Just give me two things that you kind of feel are diametrically opposed, but you know, in describing a game or any series of games, you could sort of like place games along some axis. If you have time, we can talk about another two different terms. But you know, something to help describe to people, you know, okay. This game is kind of on the far extreme of one. This game is on the far extreme of the other. The goal here is to come up with terms that are that will help you sort of identify what this, who this game might be targeted towards. You know, what kind of player this game might be targeted. Not necessarily using Bartle's terminology at all. But Bartle's terminology, as we have said, is kind of weak. So let's throw out some other words, some other things. Use things that you use to describe games already, but you know, if that fails because you haven't really thought about it, then we come up with some new words, you know, real English words.
Just come up with potential some like Greek words.
Yeah.
I got.
Random versus strategy.
Oh, wait.
Hey.
Original versus copy.
Clearly that point resonates, right? It makes it, it's fairly sort of easy to sort of like discuss this, you know. I mean, I'd rather use word chance, but random, you know, get the point across pretty clearly. Yeah.
Strategy or random versus deterministic?
Right, so I think the axes should be random, deterministic, and or reactive and deliberative.
I like that. That's fancy.
We use big words in this.
Wow.
What's the other one again?
Reactive and deliberative.
Reactive and deliberative.
Or random and deterministic.
Oh, deterministic.
Random.
Yeah. Because you can definitely still have randomness and have strategy.
Right.
But random and deterministic are
different.
Yeah. Then there would be somewhere on the axis, right?
So,
well, I mean, the problem is you can have like incredible amounts of randomness, but if you can just like figure out the probabilities, you can still have like an optimal strategy, right?
That's true. But then that's what's random.
Hooker.
Deterministic is kind of interesting because you can't have a system that's so complex yet deterministic that there's no way you can predict what's going to happen next.
Yeah. Killer robot.
It's theoretically possible, but yeah, you know, this is.
I mean, even the night games is bringing it.
Is any other?
Player versus system agency.
Player versus system and agency is kind of your.
It's distributed.
It's the name of your. Axis, right?
Yes.
Okay. We also had a low learning curve versus high learning curve. You're definitely not booked into that.
Low.
Fast versus slow.
So. So another axis we had was, I guess you call it
the like freedom and like the predetermined like paths in the game.
Like, constraint?
Yeah, well,
like
freedom versus constraint.
Yeah, I can't remember the terms, but it was like ludus and piety or something like that.
Okay, so one word that I use, that I hear often to sort of describe freedom in games are on rails. I mean, I remember people describing it for 13 hours of Final Fantasy. 13 hours of Final Fantasy, on rails. You get to do one thing, you get to push the X button.
For 60 hours.
Totally worth it.
Sandbox, I would say, is kind of a subset of what you're talking about, but it's a very broad one. It's one that people generally understand as embodying this sort of like freedom. Like you get to dig around, basically, right? You know, you get to play Grand Theft Auto, totally not following the storyline. You know, actually, as time goes on, it becomes a little bit less of that. You get to do less crazy things. But the whole idea is like that world has ramps everywhere, so that you can drive cars.
There's like realism versus abstraction.
So the
difference between, you know, like EVE Online, for example, which is supposed to be very realistic, simulating something, whereas poker, for example, is just cards and numbers.
Something on the freedom sandbox versus freedom on rails. There's a very interesting thing in, at least I've seen it done in Baldur's Gate 2, where there's a predetermined point in the game where you are told you need X amount of money to be able to pay for the ship out of here. And you're placed in a sort of sandbox environment, and you are given, you're not told, but you can have whatever ways you can think of to make that amount of money. Once you have that amount of money, you can leave that part of the game.
So
it's a predetermined sandbox section.
It's a lot of adventure games, a lot of role playing games are largely predetermined with areas of freedom. Even in a game like Final Fantasy, maybe not totally, but in other games in the series, the story is largely predetermined. But what you do in combat is very, very fluid. And that's kind of like the dichotomy that Square Enix, well, Square and in the past, kind of decided that was okay. This helps us cater to people who want some flexibility in how they're going to play by making the combat system fluid enough that they can do play the way they want. But also lets us cater to the people who really want that long overarching epic narrative. You know, and we can only create one. We can't branch into another different entity because it will be too expensive to make.
So that's definitely a lot to completing your objective.
I'm not so sure that tells you if the game is catered to. Like, it might tell you something about the constraints on like the budget or the.
I prefer games that are much more like multiple decision oriented. I guess it doesn't have to be terrible.
Right. Because the interesting thing about multiple solutions is single solutions, and multiple solutions, it could be all designed. Like I could design in a game. In fact, if you play Deus Ex. Or any of the sequels, they specifically stated that they made this game with multiple solutions in mind. And with Deus Ex 2, they designed it so that they thought this puzzle needs to have three solutions, and they actually will design the environment for it. So while the game kind of like touted it as, you know, you get to play with the system, you get to, you know, figure out how all these things combine and come up with solutions on your own. Really, they try to like design it so that, you know, you have three very clear options at given time. But they wanted people to realize that they had options. And so you can have multiple solutions. Whereas this like freedom sandbox thing kind of implies not necessarily design. Like, you know, you've got lots of little things that you can do and lots of different spaces that you can explore, but it's not like you've got one obstacle and three different ways to solve it. You've got all kinds of different things that you could be doing. You could be like choosing not to go for the rest of the time. So these are different axes. I just want to point out that these are different ways to look at different things.
You can have in terms of rule changing games, whether it's dynamic rules or static rules.
So upper dynamic, static, and then one. Yeah. Are the rules going to change at the end of the game? Yeah, there are some games over here where the whole bunch has changed rules.
Like Flux.
It's not this one. But there's a whole bunch of board games as well.
Competitive versus cooperative?
In the middle of the rules,
we had this before,
yeah.
And then the whole spectrum.
PvP version.
Come on.
Cooperative. And there's still a unique way to play with the population. Okay.
Time scale of decisions?
So, short model?
Well, yeah, like Twitch games versus deep thought games.
Contemplate decisions. Sort of like they're contemplative and reactive.
Yeah, how is that compared to reactive and deliberative? Is that you guys going for basically the same thing? Like reactive means things are coming at you and you have to respond really, really quickly, maybe not even really think about it. And deliberative is like a turn-based game is mostly deliberative. So like you have as much time as you want to think about how long you want to make a decision. Doesn't necessarily mean that. You know, you can have a turn-based game that's very fast-paced, you know, because the weight of any given decision is not going to be so huge. So pace, you know, I'm just going to put pace up here because I'm going to have to run this pace out, you know, slow and fast. You know, as one way of describing a game, reactive versus deliberative as a related way of describing a game. I bet you could take, like, two of these and put them on axes and then we can talk about them on a different movie. But you know, I guess every once in a while we find that game that we like both here and here at the same time. it is fine, it's just not a way to talk about these games. Okay. These are really, really useful terms. Better than models. Whoops. Sandbox
is
not real. It's more, a little bit more boxing. It's a little bit more restrictive than freedom is more like values. Sandbox on rails are more like back of the box restrictions. You know, the feature. On rails,
you
guys
can do like, yeah, you wouldn't put that in the box.